to just, you know, throw money around, and that I had all the money in the world, Central and South America, they really want to stay in their communities. They want to
in getting rid of USAID, including the office of kids, George Bush, back in 2005, because they
okay, let's all take a deep breath.
Always a good idea.
Yes, breathing is good. So we usually begin by, I ask three things. I ask who you are, how do you feel, and what do you hope to get from this conversation? So I'll start with Renee. If you could just tell us those three things, and you can take your time doing that, by all means.
So I'm Renee Alexander, and how am I feeling? Feeling pretty good today, despite the horrible things happening around. I am maintaining some hope, and I'm just hoping to have a lively conversation and learn more about both of you.
And Tom?
I'm Tom Rogers. I'm an acquaintance, a friend of Jeff's in Bend, Oregon. Feeling all right today. I am definitely very disturbed about what's going on in the world and in our country. So it will definitely influence how I feel during this and what I communicate and how I emphasize things. But I'm really happy to be here, interested to learn more about both of you.
And I'm Jeff Rollet, and it's I'm to blame for all this. and I feel pretty good, and I'm fortunate that you are sharing your time, and we can talk about your service in both the Peace Corps and USAID, and talk about what that means in the context of soft power and what that means. But basically, in history, both the Peace Corps and USAID grew out of programs in the 60s, where we were in the middle of the Cold War and developing nations were succumbing to communism, that big, bad communism that we were worried about. And John F. Kennedy got elected and asked the nation to, rather than expect what the country can do, what can you do for the country? And from that, programs grew out of that. Programs that were not necessarily domestically based, but internationally based. And so the Peace Corps came into being, and USAID followed on from that, I believe. And so we hope that we could convey what those developing countries could achieve with some assistance through a democratic country that was prosperous, and hope that we could share that prosperity with them and our democracy with them. And at the same time, we would blunt that communist influence, which was in the background of everything going on. So anyway, these programs, at least that was the intention of what we hope to accomplish. And so I'm going to start with Tom, who has served our country many ways for many years at USAID, and have him give us a brief overview of what were his intentions when he joined up, and how were those met in the process?
Well, thanks, Jeff. It's, you know, my history and USAID's history are, I'd say, fairly checkered histories, and there are not straight lines about it. I actually joined USAID after a pretty long career in helping professions and in non-governmental organizations in the refugee assistance realm and in the human services and counseling realms. So I came in not at the beginning of my career in USAID, but actually later in my professional life. I work for something called the Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance, or OFDA for short, which is the office that had the responsibility of monitoring and implementing United States humanitarian assistance and disaster assistance programs worldwide. We kind of had a sister in the U.S. State Department, which was called the Refugees and Migration, which was in charge of refugee programs and in charge of programs that State Department had responsibility for funding. But our USAID program was primarily in charge of things related to displaced persons. So everybody who is displaced within their own countries, and also response to natural and also human caused disasters. So until this past year, when the Trump administration shut down USAID along with DOGE, that was what we were doing. I retired in 2018, so I'd been away from the agency for a while when this occurred, but it was devastating for me personally, to a lot of my friends and colleagues, and of course, devastating throughout the world that have been depending upon assistance from the United States.
Why did you choose this, Tom? And where did you serve over your life?
Yeah, well, and you know, I came to after USAID after working in NGOs or non-governmental organizations in Asia and in the Middle East, Central Asia. And the kind of work that I was doing in those non-governmental organizations was very similar to the kind of work that I did in USAID, except in our office in USAID, we were a donor agency. So, you know, I came out of organizations that were receiving support from USAID to do their work into USAID and serving kind of like a grant officer and doing assessments and working with organizations that USAID funded. So I started out in USAID. I guess the first assignment I had was working in Liberia, in Monrovia, Liberia, where I was working in our response to the post-war Liberia. That this was happening in 2003, I guess. Soon after that experience, I went to Iraq, where I was working in the humanitarian response to displacements and disaster that happened in Iraq during and after the war. And we had all kinds of U.S. and international organization and partners that we were supporting in that work in all humanitarian sectors. And then after Iraq, I worked in Jordan on Syria programs. I worked in Pakistan on Afghanistan issues. I've worked in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia, on things that were happening in Aceh there. I worked in Sudan and Darfur during the big Darfur crisis. I worked in Haiti after the big earthquake that occurred in 2005, or is it 2010? I'm sorry, 2010. I went in and out of various places in Southeast Asia and the Middle East and throughout Africa during my time with OFTA. A lot of my time was spent in East Africa, so in Kenya, in Ethiopia, working on Somalia from Kenya. I worked in West Africa on issues in Nigeria, for instance. And then I worked down in Southern Africa where we were working on Zimbabwe and the humanitarian crisis in Zimbabwe and Angola. So pretty much all over the world, I kind of ranged.
Everywhere where there was a disaster, there was Tom.
Kind of that way.
Thank you for that, first of all. Renee, I've already figured out this is too short a show. So tell me how you came to join the Peace Corps at that moment in your life and why that was important to you.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, fortunately for you and our timing, I have a lot shorter experience to relay because I got started pretty late on the Peace Corps thing. Most people join shortly after they finish college or right when they're graduating from college. And I was interested in doing that, but it was just not in the cards for me at that time in my life. It took me about 30 years to get around to actually joining the Peace Corps. And I decided to do it during the pandemic when I had been traveling for a year in South America with my partner when the pandemic started. And so we came back to the U.S. During the pandemic, and I had already been, I had taken a year off of work, and there was no work to be had. And I just had all sorts of time on my hands. And I thought, you know what, if I'm not going to join the Peace Corps now, when am I going to do it? So I started looking into it. I realized that at that point in time, the Peace Corps had changed some of their rules. It used to be that you applied and then you went wherever they sent you. You didn't really get a lot of choice in where you went, but it's changed. And now you can actually apply for a specific job in a specific country. And there were openings in Colombia for community economic development. And because I had run my own business for many years, doing consulting and marketing and public relations, community economic development in Colombia really focused on teaching entrepreneurialism to young people and to women. I felt like this was something that I could do well. I already had some Spanish background, so I felt like I had a little bit of a head start there instead of starting with a language I knew nothing about, starting from scratch. So I decided to throw my hat in the ring and got an offer to join the Peace Corps and left in September of 2022 to go live in Colombia for two years.
We'll get to what you were doing down there for sure. But this is a question that I'm sure you've heard before that everybody seems to ask when these subjects come up. But why did you choose to go to some faraway place to help people when there's so much need for help here at home? So what's your response to that, Renee? And I'll ask Tom the same thing.
That is, you know, you'd think I would have a better answer to that question. but mostly I think I come from a journalism background in addition to marketing consulting. And so this idea of being embedded somewhere really made a lot of sense to me. I felt like I had some things to offer, but I also felt like there was so much that I could learn from people in other cultures and other places. And going to visit places is not the same as living somewhere and being in a community. And I really had a strong feeling that, just like this parachute this parachuting in idea of just jumping in mm-hmm. and hitting the ground running and you know, fixing things right away with our super US skills was not a really good idea. And, you know, I thought it was not good for anyone. And so for me, the Peace Corps seemed to make a lot of sense. I liked the idea that there was, you know, a system in place to find the right place for me to be, to provide the training, to provide the security support that we would need living in a country that can, you know, has had some problems in the past. And so to me, it made more sense to go somewhere where there was a structure in place, where I could embed myself in a community and get to know a place and get to know some people and find out what they really wanted and what they really needed, instead of just going in with our idea of like, oh, I see what this place needs. You know, we should do this. And honestly, I did have ideas when I got to my community about what was needed. And sure. That was really not what was needed in that community. So my ideas changed dramatically once I got to know the community and got to know the people there. And if I had only been there for a year, there's no way that would have happened.
Tom, can you answer the same question? Why go all over the world to solve problems when there's so many problems here?
Yeah, well, you know, in my case, it was kind of a natural progression from doing work in the United States, where I was working in Minnesota in refugee programs. So for resettled refugees in Minnesota, I became very interested in, at that time, this was Southeast Asian refugees from the Vietnam War, pretty much. So I got very engaged in that, very interested in it. And I found out that there was an opportunity to go to work as a UN volunteer in a refugee camp setting in Southeast Asia. So I had never been in the Peace Corps, though a zillion of my friends had. And actually, when the Vietnam War was going on, I was heavily opposed to that, and it got very engaged in the anti-war struggle. When I graduated from university in 72, I didn't want to have anything to do with the U.S. government, including the Peace Corps. So I went the different route, and the work that I eventually engaged in wasn't long-term development. It was relief and humanitarian assistance, which was a different arena that the United States was helping with, a different way of expressing that power that you were talking about.
And I'm wondering how much discretion you were given, both of you, really, how much discretion you were given in the exercise of your jobs, where you're coming into a nation that is different from your own, with different culture, you know, different customs, and different ideas about what progress is or what their dream is for success, and you have your own ideas of what those things are. Were you basically tasked to fulfill a program that your bosses have decided for you, or were you allowed some initiative and discretion in the exercise of what you did? I'll start with Tom on that, and then we'll go back to Renee.
Okay. Well, you know, because my work with OFDR, with USAID, for the 15 years that I retired, was in response to humanitarian crises. We were pretty much all about life-saving assistance. So the needs, we would assess the scale and the level of needs, but it was pretty much pretty much cut and dried what we were responding to. We were trying to save lives of people whose lives were threatened by those crises. So in all the humanitarian sectors, we were working with our partners to alleviate that suffering and prevent further suffering. So this is in the area of food and nutrition and healthcare and sanitation and shelter, all those really critical needs that all humans have, regardless of their circumstances.
I applaud that, because people talk about weapons of mass destruction, and I'm going, you know, the real weapons of mass destruction are bad water and no food in most of the world. You know, that's where the mass destruction takes place. It's not some bomb from above. So Renee, were you given a lot of lead to do what you were doing? And on the flip side of that, were you given support to do what you were doing?
The answer is yes and no. So with the Peace Corps, so the Colombian government talks to the Peace Corps and tells them what they want. And the Peace Corps says, here's what we can offer. And so together they come up with a framework of what kind of volunteers go to a country such as Colombia. So Colombia wanted teachers to help their English teachers become better at teaching English. And then they wanted help with community economic development. And that was to help young people and women to instill in them more entrepreneurial skills. We were working in rural areas, and the idea was to help people in these areas develop the skills they need to start their own businesses, because there weren't a lot of industries. For instance, in the town I lived in, it was pretty small, and the biggest industry there was dairy. So people were dairy farmers, or they worked for the dairy factory making cheese, or going around into the campo and picking up the milk that the farmers had put out. So there just weren't a lot of jobs, and there were a lot of young people who were leaving these small communities either to go to college or to find work in larger cities. And so our job as community economic development connectors was, half of the job was to work in a local high school alongside another teacher. And in my case, it was working with the agricultural teacher, because the agricultural program also included an entrepreneurial aspect. So that was part of my job. The other part of my job was to actually go around the community and find stuff to do, find people who wanted to work with me, find out what people in the community wanted. And that was, it was one of the things that excited me, but it was also one of the things that made my job really difficult, because no one in my community understood that I was not an English teacher. They assumed anyone who came from the U.S. was an English teacher. And so most people just wanted me to teach their kids how to speak English. So I basically spent the first 6 months of my service telling people I was not an English teacher, but that if they wanted to talk about their small business, I would love to talk to them about it. Or if they wanted to learn about entrepreneurialism, or they wanted to have some classes in entrepreneurialism, or if they wanted to start a community savings club, then I was happy to help them with that. In my community, whenever I said a community savings club, they thought I was talking about a pyramid scheme. So that never went anywhere. So the projects that I ended up doing were like, I couldn't, for the entire first year, I thought, I'm never going to find a project to do anywhere because people don't understand this. But somehow after the 1 year point, people started figuring out who I was. And then they started figuring out, oh, she's not leaving. She's actually going to stick around. So then they finally started coming to me and saying, hey, can you help me with this? Or is there something that we could do together here? So I did have a lot of leeway, but there was also some structure and there was some support for things. But in many senses, we were kind of, they're like, here are some tools. Try to use them when you get there. And then we found out, you know what? They don't like these tools here. So I'm going to have to come up with something different. But, you know, I was able to reach out and get support.
And that's good.
And that
brings me to the issue of trust, of course. In most locations, when you come to someplace new, it usually takes you at least a year to get the community to accept you and trust you for who you are, instead of what they think you are, or what you think you are in that process. So, how much does trust play a role in the things you need to do to fulfill your mission, Tom?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because it's quite a different situation with somebody who's there doing relief services and disaster response than a person that's trying to do long-term development, like Renee was doing. We depended a lot upon our local partners that we were supporting with funding, and also with local community leaders to implement the programs that we were doing. And those kinds of things required a certain level of trust to implement together. And because our objectives were fairly straightforward, like delivering food or delivering healthcare or helping people get shelters, temporary shelters, people had expectations that we would be doing what we said we'd do for them. So I think they trusted us to do that stuff. But in the long haul, I think it was going to require building a different level of trust for people that were going to be there longer term. Our programs were fairly short in duration, you know, usually under mm-hmm. a year. So,
but Renee, it
was
had
a different dynamic.
Trust.
For
in,
us
in your situation, and how did that come about?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that happens in Colombia, at least, and in many other Peace Corps countries, is that when you get placed in a community, they also place you with a host family, and so you have a family there who is helping you. They're introducing you to people. They're helping you understand the local customs, understand the local schedule, because in Colombia, at least in rural Colombia, everything is word of mouth. And if you're not part of that grapevine, you don't know anything going on. And so I was in the dark a lot of the time about a lot of things. And so having a host family there, being integrated into a family, is one of the things that they do to help you integrate into a community and build trust. But there still is a big level of, as you mentioned, figuring out what you're doing, what your role is in the community, getting people to understand and accept you for who you are instead of what they expected you to be. Because in general, people thought that I was just a walking bag of money, and that I was there to just, throw money around, and that I had all the money in the world, and that I lived in a mansion like the Kardashians. And it took a really, really long time to dispel that myth. There really is a big belief in a lot of countries that everyone in the U.S. is filthy rich, and that we just throw money around. And I guess they have good reasons for believing that, because that's what our media culture teaches people around the world. So I had to dispel a lot of myths before I could get people to trust me. And also, it was a great thing that they had me paired up with a local teacher, because that teacher was able to help me get introductions to other people. And I had time to talk to him with my broken Spanish, my not quite fluent Spanish, so that he could understand what I was trying to accomplish, and he could convey that more clearly to other people than I could when I was getting frustrated without being able to eloquently explain what I was trying to do in the second language. But definitely after the first year of being there, and people realized who I was, what I was there to do, and that I wasn't going away, That's when things really started happening. And that's when people started opening up to me and opportunities.
And what were some of those
things? Sustainable in the community really started happening. So the big project that I did there was actually with USAID funding. We built a sustainable greenhouse and garden. It was a demonstration garden. So in the school that I worked in, students for their final project were, they had to take a local crop, locally grown crop, and develop a value-added product from that. And they had to develop an entire business plan and marketing plan and the product itself. So that was a full-scale project for them to do. And they worked in groups of three or four students, and they had to purchase whatever the product was, whatever the crop was, in order to make their products. They had to create their own labels, had to develop marketing plans, everything around it. And so what we wanted to do was build a greenhouse where the entire class could grow one crop and develop one product made from that so that they could scale it up. And then that students could work in different parts of a school-based business. And then the money that that came from whatever product that they created would go back into the program to buy any machinery they needed to develop the products, to buy packaging, so that the students wouldn't have to pay for this out of their own pockets and do small projects. And so I wrote a grant proposal for this project, and we were able to complete it. We built a greenhouse. We put in an irrigation system. We did a rain catchment system. And that project is still there. And there's a new volunteer who just got there a couple of months ago.
Well, that's good that there's continuity.
Be able to take that and hopefully move it to the next level.
What was the plant? What was the crop?
Yes. So the first crop that we grew there was tomatoes. Interestingly enough, the first crop of tomatoes that they put in, the neighbor's chickens got into the greenhouse and ate most of the tomatoes, or just pecked at them and destroyed them all. So we had to start over from scratch and have a talk with the farmer next door to make sure he knew to keep his chickens out of there. So yes, tomatoes was the first crop. We also grew some strawberries. I think that was more of a test project. And the instructor that I worked with was really interested in oyster mushrooms. So
There's a book called Ripples on the Zambezi, which is a book by an Italian gentleman. I can't pronounce his last name anymore, but he was an international development specialist, and he went to Kenya, I believe, and developed a program where they could irrigate portions from the river and grow tomatoes, and they put in this crop along the river, and they grew exceedingly beautiful tomatoes, and they had all these tomatoes growing along the river, and they were just about ready to harvest them. They were just turning red and getting ready to be harvested. And they came back 2 days later and the whole crop was devastated and gone. And nobody could understand why that happened. And then they looked out in the river and they saw the ripples in the river from the hippos. And that was the lesson of, you know, do something that is, compatible with your community and with your land, rather than try to impose your particular brand of development on somebody. Tom, your organization.
Absolutely. I would say that is one of the biggest complaints internationally of U.S. support is that we tend to just come in and tell them what we think they need to do, and we don't consider the local context, and things don't really work out.
Yeah, I mean, one of the, I was just going to say in response to what Renee was talking about, there were lots of interfaces or cooperation between the Peace Corps and other groups that were doing long-term development assistance with the work that we did in the disaster assistance realm too, in terms of trying to save and restart livelihoods that people had that been wiped out by conflict or drought or flooding. So all those things, there was a lot of interweaving of this stuff. And that's one of the reasons why it's been so devastating that USAID has been completely shut down, because I worked on the disaster side, but there's the huge part of USAID that was focused on long-term development and agriculture and livelihoods
and short-term
education and all those things. They're all
short-term
gone.
Assistance is all great gone. For the people there who are receiving the assistance, but in terms of the, I guess, the geopolitical value of it, it doesn't really have much of a determining value of, yes, you kept them alive, but I don't know if they're going to be able to have the stability or the future to consider the value of what you're doing and prosper from it. So thank you for the assistance of that, but it's not necessarily going to translate into I'm ready to accept the American dream and wave the flag in that process, because once you go away, then we're back in the same situation, and it's frustrating in that regard. There is a bias out there because we are walking bags of money to most of the developing world, and so there's that bias that we need to overcome. And how do you assess success in that process? At least, Renee, your project is going to have some legs. It's going to continue, at least for now. But you know, the next volunteer could screw it up in that process. So I guess I'm wondering, we all do things that we're hoping for the better, and there's always the prospect of failure. So what is it that motivates you guys to keep going in that process? I'll start with Tom, since you've been going for a long time.
I'll find
it. Tom, please.
Renee.
What
motivates me to keep going on it? Well, obviously, since I retired, I haven't kept going on it. But, what kept me going was seeing the results of our shorter-term interventions, our humanitarian